Failure, it turns out, is an option.
What is so strange about being honest and saying, I want Barack Obama to fail if his mission is to restructure and reform this country so that capitalism and individual liberty are not its foundation? Why would I want that to succeed?
Rush Limbaugh, a man who says he basically can't hear, speaks to Republicans about seeing the path forward for conservatives in the Obama era. Is this a case of the deaf leading the blind, or have I just joined the vast left-wing conspiracy? Find out on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Monday, March 2nd. I'm John Hockenberry. Adora Udoji is away. And Femi, don't you think Rush Limbaugh would have loved my dismissing of political correctness there? If he'd heard it, he would love it. That's right. Coming up this hour, we'll hear all the dirt from CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, where Rush Limbaugh spoke over the weekend. We'll also discuss the agenda in Washington and overseas and the expected nomination of Kansas Governor Kathleen Sebelius as next Health and Human Services Secretary. Those stories coming up, but first, the top headlines. How the mighty have fallen, we might say. AIG was once the world's largest insurer. Then, this morning, it announced the biggest quarterly loss in corporate U.S. history, $61.7 billion. The federal government managed to find $30 billion to help it with its bailout. That was also announced. Overseas Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in Egypt today to attend an international donors conference for the reconstruction of the Gaza Strip. She's pledging $900 million in U.S. aid. U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is there, too. He told delegates they must take action immediately.
The people of Gaza cannot and should not wait any longer. We must move on, and we must move forward. There is only one viable future, Palestinians and Israelis living side by side in peace and security. This is our moment.
Total aid pledges are expected to exceed $3 billion. Femi, okay? Can you top that?
I'm going to try with a new cabinet pick expected to be announced today. President Obama is expected to name Kansas Governor Kathleen Sebelius as his next Secretary of Health and Human Services. She's his second choice for the job. His first pick, former Senator Tom Daschle, withdrew over tax problems. Prime Minister Gordon Brown arrives in Washington today and will meet with President Obama tomorrow. The Prime Minister says that they'll discuss the economic problems and possibly a new global deal. And the President of Guinea-Bissau, a small nation in West Africa, has been assassinated. Renegade soldiers shot him in his palace today. The military said in a statement broadcast on the radio that it was not holding a coup and would respect the constitutional order of succession.
Here in New York, March is like a lion in terms of ferocious weather, but on the world markets, it's a bear that continues. All major indices in Europe are down more than 2%. The S&P begins trading at 735 after a loss on Friday, and futures trading suggests there will be continued losses this morning. What's the stimulus money going to do for American education? The man responsible for bringing American education into the 21st century is on our show today, Education Secretary Arne Duncan. Take your school to the principal's office in honor of his joining our conversation. Tell Arnie what problems your school faces. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. The conversation is on our website.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. Snowy day here in the Northeast. March coming in like a lion.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah, what condition my condition was in.
And we begin the takeaway with our agenda segment, looking forward this week not to the weather, which is expected to be bad both in Washington and New York, but a healthcare summit, which is the big event in Washington, D.C. President Obama made clear that healthcare reform was on the top of his priority list last week during his address to Congress. Today, besides the healthcare summit, he's set to officially announce Kansas Governor Kathleen Sebelius as his choice to head up Health and Human Services. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton makes her way to the Middle East. And in exchange, Prime Minister Brown heads to Washington this week. Kind of a bifurcated agenda, both in Washington and around the world. We begin with Anna Marie Cox from Air America, national correspondent and Daily Beast contributor. She's in Washington, D.C. Anna Marie Cox, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
So healthcare is going to be on everyone's mind, trying to keep from falling down on the icy streets of Washington, D.C. today. but how important is it that the Obama agenda has finally moved to healthcare after so much anticipation and so much sort of negotiating through the weeds of the stimulus package and the budget?
Well, it's going to be another set of negotiations, and it looks like he's going to be treating this healthcare summit and also the rollout of the plan in the same way he kind of treated the stimulus, which is to go on the campaign trail. He's going to Ohio this week, and also he has this healthcare summit where we're probably going to be seeing a lot of unhappy people. I think they're going to bring out some members of the public, bring out voters who are unhappy with their healthcare, which shouldn't be too hard to find, really.
And basically, you see on two levels, a preemption of what was the very powerful Republican argument during the Clinton years that, number one, this is going to cost too much, and number two, it's going to scare people. It sounds like the Obama administration is basically going to find people who are already scared and put them front and center, and he's led with the cost. He's basically said, this is the money we have, we're going to do it with this. Does that nullify the debate over cost, do you think, among Republicans?
Oh, I think Republicans are still going to talk about it. I mean, they're still unhappy about the stimulus package, obviously. And they just but in a weird way, I wonder, I don't have any particular insight on this, but I wonder if getting that stimulus package through will make it easier to get health care through, because people now feel like, okay, yeah, let's throw money at it. This is how we solved one problem or how we want to solve a problem, and maybe this will work too. I think the attitude of the American public towards the stimulus plan, which is that things are so bad that we just need to throw a lot of money at it, and we're not going to worry about it, what the particulars of the plan are. If that worked for Obama with the stimulus package, I mean, he may be trying that again with the healthcare package. And I also think it's interesting, he is just giving a broad outline to Congress. He really wants Congress to fill in the details on this. But you're right. I mean, I think he's very much sort of setting this up as a mandate from a lot of people that we recognize. When we hear him talk about this, we're going to be hearing about a lot of specific people, and you sort of see ourselves in it. I think that's his point.
Right. So see ourselves, and that's a great takeaway, that we actually have become inoculated to all these zeros in this era of $700 billion for this, $300 billion for that. This morning, apparently the Treasury is going to give an extra $30 billion to AIG, which will announce its own $62 billion loss. So we've got sort of
billion there.
Yeah, exactly right. finally, take a listen to this possibly familiar voice, Anna Marie Cox.
This notion that I want the president to fail, folks, this shows you a sign of the problem we've got. That's nothing more than common sense, and to not be able to say it. What is in this? What possibly is in this that any of us want to succeed?
Apparently, failure is an option for radio host Rush Limbaugh. What was the context of that, and who was he speaking with? And I know you spent some time with GOP leaders and youngsters searching for a way forward in this Obama era in Washington.
Right. The Conservative Political Action Conference was at the Omni Shoreham in Washington, but really it was in the wilderness. it's an annual event that brings a lot of conservative students to Washington, but also it's sort of a rite of passage for anyone interested in the Republican nomination to headline there. That's not to say that I think Rush Limbaugh is interested in the Republican nomination, but he was a headliner at the event along with Ann Coulter, Huckabee, Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty, a whole range of people, but really it's kind of to the right a little bit. Pawlenty was a moderate at this conference. And it was weird, though. People asked me if the attitude down there seemed depressed or there was a lack of energy. Really, this is like a part of the party that enjoys being exiled. They like being on the defensive. And also their message to themselves, at least, I don't know if this is going to carry into Republican moderate message is that we have lost because we aren't conservative enough. They feel like this is an opportunity to take their party even further to the right.
So maybe
it's a little bit mind-bending. It's like being a little bit on another planet.
So, but maybe they're delivering the argument that Rahm Emanuel made over the weekend, that actually for the conservative movement, Rush Limbaugh is the conscience of it, and for Republicans can distance themselves from Rush Limbaugh only at their peril. We've got to move on to the overseas agenda, but you know, congratulations on being the Twitter pioneer. Washington has become Twitter City, and you were there at the beginning, huh?
I was there at the beginning. I actually used Twitter to cover the Republican primary contest. And I never really saw it getting this big, but welcome David Gregory and the rest of the Washington elite to my world.
Well, we got thousands of them from you at CPAC. Thank you, Anna Marie Cox, Air America national correspondent and Daily Beast contributor.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah, what condition my condition was in.
Our pledge of over $900 million designed in coordination with the Palestinian Authority and to be submitted to the United States Congress will deliver assistance to the people of Gaza and the West Bank.
Continuing with our agenda segment now, that's Hillary Clinton, of course, speaking in Sharm el-Sheikh this morning. We continue to look at the week ahead in terms of news from around the world. And joining us now is Jonathan Marcus, BBC diplomatic editor. He joins us from our partners, the BBC in London. Jonathan, let's talk about Hillary Clinton there for a moment. Is this an opportunity for the Secretary of State in a transition moment in Israel to, aside from hand out money in Gaza, to flex some muscle in the Obama administration's relationship with the Middle East?
I think it's early days yet, so I think she's going to be trying to set out the American stall to try and underline that it's still a two-state solution that the United States and most of the international community believes is the answer in the region. But two important qualifications in that comment from her at the conference. One, that the United States continues to deal with the Palestinian Authority, and also this headline figure of $900 million. Not all of it is new money, I understand. Not all of it is going to Gaza. A large slice is going to go to bolstering the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, letting it be able to pay wages and so on. So again, early days, but all the indications are that US policy is steady as she goes, keeping Hamas at arm's length, focusing very much upon bolstering the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank.
Jonathan Marcus, British Prime Minister Gordon Brown arrives in snowy Washington and will have meetings at the White House. I'm wondering this week what the agenda is of the British Prime Minister, both in terms of his own voters in the UK and also in projecting the economic viability of Britain right now.
Well, a hugely important meeting for Prime Minister Brown. Obviously not a figure who has perhaps the name recognition or the charisma and popularity in the United States of his predecessor, Tony Blair. It's important for him on the economic front to get the Obama administration on board with a crucial G20 meeting coming up in London next month. Stimulus, fiscal packages, all of those issues on the table. Also crucially, talks about Afghanistan, where Britain remains the largest non-US troop contributor. But very important for Mr. Brown at home. He's very much in the doldrums here. He's trying to hone his image as he would have it as an economic savior. And so this visit is very, very important to him on the domestic British front, not least at a time when he's facing an American president. All the stories tell us Mr. Obama, one of his early acts was to take a bust of Winston Churchill, the great British wartime leader, out of his office in the White House, replace it with one of Abraham Lincoln. So on the face of it, a president who is perhaps so naturally friendly towards Britain. That's not to say that he is unfriendly, but I think we'll all be watching the body language of this visit to see what it tells us about the apparent special relationship between London and Washington.
Well, that's an interesting detail there. Any likelihood that behind the scenes, there will be some tension about issues like bank nationalization and interest rate cuts by the Bank of England?
there will be some tensions. I think, though, very important is going to be Mr. Brown's speech to the joint session of Congress. After all, I don't think he quite has to persuade President Obama of the track he wants to take, but certainly there are many still sceptical voices on Capitol Hill, and I think that speech to Congress will be in some ways as important, if not more important, than the meetings with President Obama.
Well, an interesting relationship between the two countries just starting out. Jonathan Marcus, BBC diplomatic editor, talking about Gordon Brown heading his way to Washington. Thank you, Jonathan.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. After some provocative outtakes on education policy last week on the program, our conversation continued with your comments all weekend long. Arne Duncan, the Secretary of Education, joined us this morning, and in honor of that, we want you to take your school to the principal's office and tell the secretary what problems your school faces.
Good morning. My name is Jill Warter. I'm a music teacher in a Title I school in Baltimore City. I'm calling. I want to encourage you to put some kind of accountability structure into NCLB. For example, 80% of Baltimore City high schools don't have a music teacher. This amounts to a cultural disenfranchisement.
NCLB, that's No Child Left Behind. Tell us and the Secretary of Education what you need for your schools at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. The administration is watching and listening, so go to our website. It's year one for Russian Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev. Why are we focusing on that? Well, possibly because so much has changed in a single year, particularly for the government in Russia. Vladimir Putin is still in the picture, of course. He's prime minister. And to learn about what this year means and to contrast how different Russia is today from when Medvedev took power a year ago, we spoke with Alexei Solohubenko, BBC Russia analyst for our partners, the BBC. Alexei joined us from London's Bush House for an interview conducted earlier this morning. And when we spoke, I asked Alexei if today it wasn't easier to determine who really held the reins of power in Russia, the current or former prime minister.
I think so. If you ask the Russian public, the Russian people, and if you trust the opinion polls conducted in Russia, the majority, the overwhelming majority, still believe that Putin is in control and Medvedev is a kind of an important player, but not really. And if you look at the economic side of things, certainly Putin is in control of oil, is more in control of gas. I think it is clear that a lot has changed in terms of people at the top visually. But in terms of actual operational mode, Putin is very much pushing the buttons.
And talk about approval rating in Russia. It's a difficult thing to measure. I'm wondering if the invasion of Georgia had any effect on Medvedev's standing, or is it, again, as you say, all Putin?
I think it was very important for Medvedev to actually prove that he is somebody who takes decision, who makes decision. And if you watched him on television screens during the conflict with Georgia, which I did, it was very interesting to see how he began to walk the walk and talk the talk. He developed the kind of Putin swagger, and he was more robust. He accentuated his phrases to project the image of a very resolute president, of a very resolute politician. Sometimes it certainly was a pale copy of Mr. Putin, who had it naturally, but clearly the it was more than image. It was the desire by Mr. Medvedev to put his stamp on the very, very important and extremely unpopular, as it appears, decisions of recognizing, for instance, the independence of South Ossetia and Abkhazia. But the key thing, I guess, is that despite that talking the talk and walking the walk, the issue has not been resolved. resolved. There was a military victory over Georgia, but a lot of underlying factors of North Caucasus, of instability there, of violence there, violence in the rest of Russia, are still something that that is yet to be resolved, and it's not clear how it will be under the current conditions.
Well, the walk the walk, talk the talk issue, maybe you can only get that natural swagger if you're trained at the KGB like Putin was. Medvedev maybe has a different resume. But let's talk a little bit about the question of what has changed. The oil price is down so low. The anticipated investments in Russian economic development that the oil money was going to bring are not there anymore. Perhaps it's possible that Medvedev is grateful to Putin because he's going to take all the blame if things economically go south.
Well, I think this is not certain, and this is the key question facing the Russian public and all the Kremlinologists and analysts of Russian politics. Obviously, there would need to be some kind of a scapegoat, but it's not clear at all whether Mr. Putin will take the blame. If you look very carefully at how Mr. Medvedev, for instance, was plugged into the gas war with Ukraine and how directly he was involved in negotiations, his past record of the chair of Gazprom, the Russian oil monopoly. Gas monopoly. I think it was clear that both of them will have to be somehow involved in these things. And I'm not sure that actually Putin will be blamed because Putin, more than Medvedev, is associated with stability
right.
that preceded this economic crisis.
Well, then finally, what of a kind of constitutional structural shift are you seeing in the way Putin has played this? Are we seeing the evolution of a kind of rotating presidency in Moscow, where whether they're president or prime minister, the head of state is sort of rotating around in this kind of a dual or even committee structure?
I think recent changes to the constitution, which extended the term of presidency, is an indication that Mr. Putin is not going to go away. He is 52, Mr. Medvedev is 42, but I think both are quite optimistic about their political future. I think the local elections that just took place over the weekend in about 40% of Russian municipalities is an indication that United Russia, Mr. Putin's party, of which Mr. Putin is the chairman, has done relatively well considering the crisis and economic problems. And I think this gives Mr. Putin a very good power base to be in control for many years to come, either as a prime minister or a president. Very often in Russia, in the current setup, that doesn't really matter. The real matter is control.
Indeed. I'd like to thank my guest, BBC Russia analyst Alexei Solohubenko, who joined us earlier this morning to talk about control and President Medvedev's first year and apparently an open-ended commitment of years of control for Vladimir Putin. And now?
Hello, Americans. This is Paul Harvey. Stand by for news.
Stand by for news. Paul Harvey passed over the weekend. We are grateful to have Femi Okeh here with the headlines.
Thank you very much. The time is coming up to 29 minutes past the hour. Good morning. Senior military officers from North Korea and the US-led United Nations Command in South Korea have held their first talks for 6 years. UN Command says that North Korea requested the meeting to discuss how to reduce tension along the north-south border. It was the first meeting of its kind in 7 years. Iran is dismissing US concerns about how much nuclear material the country has produced. It denied today it's developing a nuclear bomb. The comments come a day after a top US military official says that the country has sufficient materials for a weapon. President Obama is expected to announce Kansas Governor Kathleen Sebelius as his choice for Health and Human Services Secretary today. The news comes just days before a White House summit on healthcare. If confirmed by Congress, Sebelius will face a host of challenges, including being the public face for the Obama administration's health policy. Winter storm warnings are blanketing the Atlantic coast states today. Areas from North Carolina to New Hampshire expect to see 8 to 12 inches of snow. And the storm blew through the region last night and has stopped hundreds of flights. And that's a look at big stories making news this morning.
Do you have trouble getting here this morning?
I just started off extra early.
That's what we all did. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Boy, some of you responding to Education Secretary Arne Duncan think it's going to be pretty difficult to get education in the U.S. into the 21st century.
Hello, I'm a high school teacher in a Michigan high school. Our technology policy in our high school completely inhibits my ability to prepare these kids for college. These kids are not allowed to save on a memory stick and bring something in to work on it. They're not allowed to work at school, save, and bring it home. Everything has to be done at school or at home. Ridiculous. It's all in the name of not getting viruses on the school's computers.
Tell us and Secretary Arne Duncan what you need for your schools at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. The secretary has joined the conversation. You can, too, and you can hear the conversation at thetakeaway.org. So I want to apologize in advance to all of you parents as I possibly infuse your life with uncertainty and guilt yet again. Question now, which way does your baby face in the stroller? Is it forward or back towards you? Okay, if you answered forward, there's a study in Britain that's not going to make you terribly happy. It says that babies who face their caregiver talk more, laugh more, and interact more, and that may have an effect on brain development of especially young children. It's the subject of an op-ed piece for our partners, the New York Times, this morning. And one of the people referred to in that article is Liz Attenborough. She's the manager at Talk to Your Baby National Literacy Trust. Liz, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, this is a disturbing development. The idea that strollers, and I don't know if you've seen strollers recently. I mean, they look like Bentleys lately. I mean, they're all about safety and caregiving for children. But if the child is faced the wrong way, you may be doing your child harm. Explain.
Well, our starting point on this was how can we get more children to arrive at kindergarten, nursery, better communicators, because there are certainly very great concerns in the UK that too many children are arriving with very poor communication skills. And one of the things that early years professionals over here were saying to me when we started the Talk to Your Baby campaign was that, well, if the stroller is facing away, there's all that wasted time when they're not having any communication, they're not having eye contact, they're just looking aimlessly ahead without any kind of stimulation. So that was our starting point, to look at, you know, is this a factor? And we don't want to make parents feel guilty about this. It's the last thing we want to do. In fact, I've been working on this sort of behind the scenes for 5-6 years, trying to get the stroller manufacturers to make more options so that there are two-way facing strollers that can be used in both modes of direction. They do exist, but they are very expensive. They're the sort of $700 option. And so what I was trying to do was get more manufacturers to make more models that were at the lower price end, because you can get a perfectly good one for $50. But it will only face fixed away from the pusher.
You know, I'm wondering.
But I was just getting nowhere. So we sort of, I found this fabulous researcher who, I mean, she was just amazed that she's been doing it for something like 12 years. She's been studying infant-parent interaction. And she just said, I can't believe I never thought about the stroller option, because that is such a big part of many young children's day, is sitting in that thing, and they're just missing out.
It seems to me in the development of stroller technology, which has been extraordinary in the time that I've been a dad for the last 10 years, that there have been a lot of options for the pusher of the stroller, but relatively few for the actual child. I mean, once you stop being a little tiny infant, where the baby does face the caregiver, you're basically looking at tailpipes. That's pretty much it.
You're very low on the ground, as you say, and And it's as if the child has just not been thought about this. It's kind of like, what height should the handles be that's convenient for the jogger or the mum or the dad? What we're saying is, let's look at it from the child's point of view. And the child actually would so much prefer to be looking into someone's eyes, because that's where they get their stimulating the start from. And I think they should be facing the pusher right up until they get out of the stroller and start walking.
You've identified the economic problem. Lots of strollers are going to be hand-me-downs. It's going to take a very difficult time to get the price down, as you've described, and for this to work its way through the system. But before we go, the amount of talking that parents do to children, according to this research, and it's preliminary, is really significantly different whether the child faces forward or back. Tell us the numbers.
Well, it's really twice. I mean, the best way, if you're a child, the best thing to do is get someone to carry you. That's when you get most interaction. Second best is if you're old enough to be walking, and then you get interaction too. But that's probably because you are old enough and you may be instigating some of it. But even in the study that we did with 20 parents with their young children, and they were wired up, so they knew they were being listened to, and they went first, some of them went first with the child facing away, some facing towards them, and even though they knew they were being listened to, they spoke more than twice as much when the baby was facing them. And fantastically, the babies laughed more. 10 of the 20 babies laughed when they were facing their parents, and only one kind of half laughed when they were facing away. And they need that kind of stimulation to get their brain going and to get the communication set.
It's amazing. Even though it's just preliminary data on the stroller issue, it's still very interesting information regarding brain development and interaction with parents. Liz Attenborough, manager at Talk to Your Baby National Literary Trust, joined us from London, urges all parents not to feel guilty. Her research is referred to in an op-ed in the New York Times today. And facing very much forward is Femi Okeh here with the headlines.
Thank you very much. The time is 22 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning. The insurance giant AIG announced this morning that the biggest quarterly loss in corporate US history at $61.7 billion. The federal government is providing the company with an extra $30 billion in bailout funds. It's AIG's fourth federal rescue since September. Overseas Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in Egypt today to attend an international donors conference for the reconstruction of the Gaza Strip. She's pledging $900 million in U.S. aid. Representatives from more than 70 countries are attending the conference, including the Middle East envoy and former British Prime Minister Tony Blair. Blair says that he hopes reconstruction in Gaza will help the peace process.
It's our task to try and make sure now, with the conference in Sharm el-Sheikh, that we pledge the money for reconstruction, but also outside of that conference, that we work for a basis of lasting peace, where such destruction does not happen again.
Total aid pledges for the Gaza Strip are expected to exceed $3 billion. Also in international news, soldiers have killed Guinea-Bissau's president in his palace earlier today. And that happened just hours after a bomb killed his rival, the nation's armed forces chief. The military said in a statement broadcast on the radio that it was not holding a coup. Back in the US, the Blackwater founder, Eric Prince, is stepping down as the company's chief executive. Last month, the State Department said it would not rehire Blackwater after its contract expires in May. The company's came under fire in 2007 after its security guards were accused of killing 14 Iraqi civilians in a busy Baghdad square. And a new survey shows that credit card holders aren't paying attention to charges in their policies. Credit.com says more than 60% of those surveys didn't know what changes their cards had made.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. It could be the biggest story today. We've referred to it a couple of times. The federal government is stepping in to bail out AIG, the insurance giant. It announced a massive $62 billion loss this morning. It loses $62 billion. The government found an additional $30 billion in taxpayer money to keep AIG going. Joining us now is Andrew Ross Sorkin, chief reporter on mergers and acquisitions for The New York Times. Andrew, thanks for being with us.
good morning if it's Monday, right? Here we are.
Here we are. You know, I was happy to own AIG months ago. Now I own it even more. But this is a really important global market story. AIG is inextricably linked with all global markets and the Wall Street firms. Explain once again why, of all the too-big-to-fail institutions, AIG is the granddaddy.
Well, it really is the granddaddy, and people talk about systemic risk, this idea of a dominoes, if you will. If one business goes down, what happens next? We saw what happened with Lehman Brothers, and I think there's been an anxiety on the part of the government to see the same thing happen with AIG and the rest of the economy. The reason that AIG is so important is because it issues insurance policies around the world in hundreds of countries to millions of people, to businesses, and what you don't want to see is a true run on the bank in the insurance sense, which is that you could actually have people trying to turn back their life insurance policies and getting them cashed out. And if you understand the way insurance businesses work, like a bank, they don't have all the money sitting there. So if you and I decided we were going to ask to get our cash back right now, there wouldn't be enough cash to go around, and that's what you're trying to avoid. You're also trying to avoid the unraveling of all of these contracts, these derivative contracts. You know, AIG is not just an insurance company. It effectively was running a hedge fund on the side, and that's really what took it down.
So aside from its bad decisions in this sort of hedge fund realm that you referred to, AIG is really not unlike an insurance company, say a State Farm Insurance in New Orleans, where there's just been a catastrophic hurricane, except it's a global hurricane in this case.
Oh, it's exactly like State Farm on steroids in the middle of the worst hurricane you've ever seen in your life.
Wow. First of all, if AIG goes down, does it complicate this process that the Treasury is attempting to embark on to price all of these so-called toxic assets? If AIG is worth nothing, therefore the assets are worth nothing?
I think that's exactly right. Part of what you're trying to do now is hold up the entire system. So to the extent that AIG were to go down, we would start seeing serious bank failures throughout the country and perhaps the world. You know, when people say what's going to happen to Bank of America next or Wells Fargo or J.P. Morgan, to the extent that AIG runs into trouble, all of a sudden you now have trouble in the rest of those businesses.
Finally, is it possible that people who are losing their jobs might turn to their whole life insurance and try to cash them out, and that would push AIG irrevocably over the edge?
You know, that's one of the great worries. You know, we can only hope that is not the case. But in a world where you can't get a loan from the bank, where you can't get, you know, an additional loan on your credit card or an auto loan, and people are looking at their sort of last options, some of those life insurance policies can become that.
Indeed.
And if you don't have a lot of
All right, we got to go. Well, scary thoughts in a world where, as Andrew Ross Sorkin says, chief mergers and acquisitions reporter for the New York Times, talking about AIG and its $62 billion loss reported this morning.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. Coming up, what happens when absolute clarity about the death penalty meets uncertainty about who should be on death row? We'll find out in a moment right after headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thank you very much. The time is just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Consumer spending rose 0.6% in January after falling for a record six straight months. And the personal savings rate surged to 5%. That's the highest level since 1995. British Prime Minister Gordon Brown arrives in Washington today, straight from an emergency European Union summit in Brussels. He will meet with the president tomorrow and is expected to address Congress later this week. It's the president's first meeting with a European leader since taking office. Europe's biggest bank, HSBC, is trying to raise almost $18 billion from shareholders. The bank's chairman said the shot of revenue would help the firm during uncertain times. HSBC announced its pre-tax profits for 2008, and they were down 62% from the previous year. Let's look at some of the big stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi. So when Sister Helen Prejean wrote her book Dead Man Walking, she described in some compelling detail the process of being with death row inmates right up to the moment of death. It's a part of her own deep ambivalence about the death penalty itself and a search for redemption in her Christian background as a Catholic nun. Now imagine if you went on the same journey but had no such ambiguity about capital punishment, no such lack of clarity about the importance of the death penalty in providing justice. What would that journey be like then?
You expect to be executed?
Eventually. I'm starting to have my doubts, but yeah, I do.
Will you make a final statement?
Yeah.
Do you know what you're going to say?
Yeah. It's not eloquent. I do irreverence better than eloquent.
I feel like we haven't finished. I'm intending to come early tomorrow. Does your schedule, routine, whatever it is, permit our continuing this for a few minutes in the morning?
I don't even have to check my books. I'm open.
There you can hear an irreverence. There you can hear a kind of humor. But it was a fascinating collaboration between Robert Blecker, who's my next guest, professor of law at New York Law School, and the subject and producer of a new documentary film, Robert Blecker Wants Me Dead. That's him talking to convicted killer Daryl Holton, who eventually was executed. Robert Blecker, thank you for joining the program.
My pleasure, John.
And, you make a powerful argument at the beginning of this film that you absolutely believe in the death penalty, that there are people who should be executed based on their crimes, and that you sought out, by going to death row, those precise people who you think are appropriate for the death penalty, and to, in some sense, explore your feelings about witnessing their execution. It sounds like a fascinating journey, but one that's not filled with a lot of forgiveness and redemption, perhaps.
Well, I'm just as concerned that those who don't deserve it don't get it as I am that those who do. So it's not just that I sought out those who clearly deserve it. I also sought out those who didn't deserve it in order to better inform my understanding and the public understanding of what we do and why we do it.
Tell us about your relationship with Daryl Horton. How did you appear to grow on each other?
Well, it was a very strange relationship. I repeatedly told him that he deserved to die, and he repeatedly told me that I needed a psychiatrist to find out why it was so important to me. When I first met him, I had been informed that he was different from all the others, not only in the fact that he was one of the rare mass murderers. He had murdered his four children, and he had done it methodically, carefully planned, carefully carried out, but that he was just a different breed. He had foregone any rise in levels. That is to say, he kept himself on the most restrictive level on death row, refusing to have recreation with other people in the group, going out in chains and shackles every time he was out of his cell. So he refusing any appeals. So it seemed at one level as if he wanted to punish himself.
But on another level, his lack of a kind of traditional remorse comes up again and again in your film. Listen to this, and then I want to talk about this moment.
Looking back on it 10 years later, you still think that that was the appropriate expression of love for your children?
Do I wish things could have been different? Yes. Do I wish there had been other options? Yes.
Do you think about them all the time?
I don't have any problem sleeping. I don't.
So there you are asking the most unblinking question about why he killed his children and whether he believes that's an appropriate expression of love, and there's the answer. I can hear your frustration in all through this film. What did you want him to say?
I wanted him to say that he made the worst mistake imaginable. I wanted him to say that he was in pain. I wanted him to say that he regretted it, and if he had it to do again, he never would have done it.
Do you think he actually believes that and was holding that back just to deny you that?
That's an interesting question, and it's difficult to know. I mean, I waited for the letter that he must have written from Death Watch after he was executed, the letter that would come to me and say, in the 2 years, I never admitted to you that I felt remorse, but in fact, I did. And his final words, right before they killed him, they asked him if he had a final statement, and he said, I do. And that was it. the words were, I do. And there was a fair amount of speculation about what that meant. Some thought it was a reaffirmation of his wedding vows to his ex-wife, whose children he, after all, had killed. Others thought it might be, I do understand my rights and I'm waiving them by going to his death. I wanted to believe, of course it took a certain hubris, but I wanted to believe that the I do meant, I do regret it. After all, I do.
Is the story of your film the idea that far from clarity that the death penalty is supposed to give us, it actually doesn't grant that clarity, even for you who were there with the Daryl Horton till the last moment?
If I can just clarify one thing first. It's not my film. I didn't produce it. I'm just the subject of it. I didn't control it. I didn't have final cut. So it's an honest look by the filmmaker is an abolitionist. So he and I did not agree on the death penalty. But what it reveals is not only the lack of clarity. I'm in favor of the death penalty, and they say that hard cases make bad law, and hard cases make bad polemics. This was a hard case. They may make good films. I hope that this is received as such. So far it has been. But this is not a polemic. This is not a tirade in favor of the death penalty. Daryl was a more difficult case. In the film, you see somebody named David Keene who raped and strangled a six-year-old child. That's an easy case. He clearly deserves to die. There's very little redeeming about him. In Daryl's case, there was a remarkable sense of humor, a wit, an irony, and a real thoughtfulness. He, as perverse as this sounds, he loved the law. He revered it. He saturated himself in it. And so what it shows, I think, is that even if we should kill them, and in some instances we should also appreciate their humanity. It's too easy just to dismiss them as one-dimensional monsters, that there's nothing to them but their monstrous acts. And there's a lot more to them. So, yes, the film is ambivalent in the sense of a contrast between somebody who deserves to die for what he did and yet somebody who is still a human being, rich and vital and vibrant.
You're an explorer of the law. At any point, did you want to be the executioner?
Yes, but I also wanted to be the savior. I mean, I can't plant my feet emotionally with Daryl. I mean, at the last 4 hours that we met right before he was executed, which was not filmed because they wouldn't allow any tape recorders or video cameras in, I told Daryl, I can't push the button. I can't do it. And he said, that's a good thing that you can't do it. That's right that you can't do it. We've gotten too close. It was very strange. He considered me his closest friend, and there was this embarrassing moment when he told me that. And I'd be damned if I'd say, you know, you're my dear friend. I mean, he's a mass murderer.
Yeah.
And yet, I did get very close to him.
Well, Robert Blecker, it's a riveting film that you are the subject of. Robert Blecker Wants Me Dead. He's a professor of law at New York Law School and the subject of this documentary film. He joined us from snowy Long Island. Thank you, Robert.
Thank you, John.
So before we go, I'd like to introduce someone who will be joining me for the next few weeks, Farah Jadea. Former host of News and Notes and a multimedia journalist, Fry.
I'm delighted to be here.
Great
Thank
that
you.
You're here. That Robert Blecker had a lot to say.
He definitely did. And it's funny that, not funny, of course, the death penalty applied to a Daryl. There was another Daryl, Daryl Hunt, who was exonerated from death row. And it always, cases like this make me really think about how do we know? And that's something that we as journalists have gotten a chance to participate in.
Yeah, well, Blecker seemed to want to go to the place where how do we know is resolved, and he discovered there's still so much uncertainty about the death penalty.
At least he's done his homework. It seems like he really put himself on the line, ethically.
Well, that's the kind of stuff we do here on The Takeaway, so are
Absolutely.
You ready?
Absolutely. I
ready
look
for the
forward
next 3 weeks?
To it
All right, that's
every
great.
Second.
And, of course, Farah's been witnessing, as you have, Education Secretary Arne Duncan has joined us on our conversation on education. You'll be able to hear him in about 45 minutes. We want you to talk to Arne. Take your school to the principal's office, we suggested.
Hi, this is Asa. I'm a teacher at a Title I school. What I'd like to see is more options for kids who aren't going to finish high school. My experience has been there's a lot of kids who just clear kind of early on that they're not going to graduate, and unless we give them alternatives, they create problems in the school.
That's one teacher's take. Go to our website to see the conversation in full. We want yours. That's the kind of thing we get. We ask, they respond.
Love it.
So here's your takeaway. Oh, no, we don't have time for that. Anna Maria Cox, though, spent a lot of time with conservatives down in Washington. That was on our agenda segment. Go to the website to find everything. I'm John Huckenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org.
and by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Vikram Pandit to the rescue.
When I became CEO a little bit more than a year ago, I demanded accountability. I removed the people responsible for Citi's financial distress. I formed a new management team. I restructured the company. I streamlined our core business.
As the fortunes of Citigroup shrink, CEO Vikram Pandit's job security seems unchanged. Perhaps he's the only one who will take this job. I mean, it's not like his salary is a big deal.
My salary should be $1 per year with no bonus until we return to profitability.
Take this job and show it. I ain't working here no more.
Well, it's a little late for that. Inside the world of Vikram Pandit and Citigroup.
You take this job and show it.
On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Monday, March 2nd. I'm John Hockenberry. Adora Udoji is away. Coming up this hour, we'll discuss tactics used by Mexico's drug cartels in a destabilizing war on the border. We'll also look at the Obama strategy in Iraq. And later on, Education Secretary Arnie Duncan joins us. But in honor of the legendary Paul Harvey passing this weekend.
Hello, Americans. This is Paul Harvey. Stand by for news.
That's right, our top story. The federal government announced today it's providing an extra $30 billion to insurance giant AIG, but AIG chair Edward Liddy says it's only reserve, just in case, a last resort kind of fund.
The new $30 billion is a standby line. It's not necessarily something that we think we'll have to draw on right away.
The bailout is AIG's fourth since September. It comes as the company announced the biggest quarterly loss in corporate U.S. history. And just like AIG, consumers are stocking their piggy banks. A new economic indicator out this morning showed that the personal savings rate surged to 5% last month. That's the highest level since 1995. Femi, okay, can you top that?
I'm going to try with a story coming out of Egypt. That's where Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is today to attend an international donors conference for the reconstruction of the Gaza Strip. She's pledging $900 million in U.S. aid, and she also emphasized the importance of moving ahead with the peace process.
Time is of the essence. We cannot afford more setbacks and delays or regrets about what might have been had different decisions been made. And now is not the time for recriminations. It is time to look ahead.
Secretary Clinton will visit Israel and the West Bank later this week. It's her first tour of the region as America's top diplomat. Meanwhile, President Obama is expected to name Kansas Governor Kathleen Sebelius as his pick to lead the Democrat Department of Health and Human Services. The announcement comes just days before White House summit on healthcare.
Thank you, Femi. World markets taking a beating all over the world and are expected to have a lower opening on Wall Street, all because of the AIG story that we spoke about a moment ago. The S&P begins trading at 735. What is stimulus money going to do for American education? We had provocative comments about that last week in our outtake segments. You joined that conversation. The Secretary of Education, Arnie Duncan, joins it this hour. We want you to take your school to the principal's office. Tell us what your school needs. 8778-MY-TAKE.
Now, the rest of the story.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. A quick reminder, Secretary of Education Arnie Duncan is joining our conversation. You can hear it later this hour on the program. But we begin with a story about a war, not in Afghanistan or Iraq, but a war on our border. Joining us is Tracy Wilkinson, Mexico Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times, has been providing coverage for the paper's series, Mexico Under Siege, about the war between the Mexican government and the drug cartels that is very visible from American border cities like Tijuana and El Paso. Also with us is Sam Quiñones, an L.A. Times reporter who has been providing coverage for the same series and is author of two books about Mexico, True Tales from Another Mexico and Antonio's Gun and Delfino's Dream. His website is samquiñones.com. Tracy and Sam, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Good morning.
You know, listen to this, both of you. When Felipe Calderon, the Mexican president, said this last week, my jaw dropped in shock.
I have not lost at all any single point of the Mexican territory. Colombia lost during several decades, and even today, parts of its territory is in the hands of the guerrilla. But Mexico, all the territory is in the hands of the Mexican authorities.
In Mexico City, Tracy Wilkinson, when the president says, hey, I haven't lost any of the country, it seems that the bar's a little bit low in this very, very destabilizing conflict with the drug cartels.
Well, yes, and in fact, that contradicts what most of his aides have been saying for quite a while. They've been quite frank about having the fact they have lost parts of their territory, at least temporarily. You know, perhaps it's not a Colombia situation where you can define a large chunk of territory that is permanently under the hands of guerrillas or drug traffickers. Here in Mexico, it's much more fluid, but there are certainly towns, cities, parts of the state across the country where the government cannot enforce the law, cannot provide security for people or for the protection of their property, their rights, their safety. And so there are indeed parts of the territory, parts of Mexico, where the government cannot enforce the law. And that is lost territory. It is perhaps temporary. They send in the army. They regain control. But there certainly are parts of Mexico that I would say is not under the control of Felipe Calderón.
And Sam Quiñones, you've seen this up close and firsthand. How is the law, according to the cartels, enforced on something as simple as who's going to be the chief of police in a border town?
Well, recently, of course, I'm sure you're referring to the case in Ciudad Juarez where the gunman out there left banners around town saying that the chief of police had to resign or they would kill an officer, I believe it was every 48 hours, if he did not. And they killed, I think, one 48-hour period passed where they killed one officer, and with that, the fellow resigned, and there's now a military commander in charge of Juarez police. So that's exactly one example of this kind of thing going on. In other cases, I would say the cartels are not organized enough to do that. I would refer you to Tijuana, where there's lots of mayhem. It's really between two factions of one cartel that's in the process of either disintegrating or reconstituting itself. I'm not quite sure sometimes, but you do have this kind of power simply brought on either by a new brazenness or by the instability that comes with top-level leaders being arrested or killed.
So this is a direct response to an aggressive initiative on the part of the Mexican government to try to take down the cartels.
Right, and I would say that is actually what's new. It's true that there are parts of Mexico that sometimes are not in control of the government's not in control. However, I would also say that this is a very, very new thing. You know, for many years, the Mexican government, or I should say elements of the Mexican government, organized and controlled drug trafficking
right.
for their own gain.
I mean,
that is what's new here. This Calderón's government has decided that it's not going to play these rules that were set up back in really in the early 70s, late 60s, or maybe early 70s, and reached their lowest point when I was in Mexico in 1994 and then 1995 when Carlos Salinas' brother The then president, Carlos Salinas's brother, Raul, was found to have had $300 million in different foreign bank accounts, all the result of money from the Gulf cartel for protection,
right.
Essentially. I mean, it's kind of the government for a long time said, this is where you guys go. This is kind of let them do it. And now this government is saying, okay, that's over. Those days are over.
Yeah, the protection racket, the sort of protection racket between the government and the cartels is over. Tracy Wilkinson, if the U.S. is giving military assistance, and Robert Gates, the Secretary of Defense, suggested that that was definitely the plan on the part of the Obama administration, is that politically popular in Mexico? And does the Colombian example give people confidence in places like Mexico City?
Well, there has been, it's been somewhat controversial, in part because initially there were requirements, strings attached to the money that said Mexico had to meet certain human rights requirements and such, and that was seen as interference. But I think overall Mexicans think the United States needs to do a lot more. The money that the U.S. is promising right now is really a drop in the bucket compared to what traffickers have and what is needed. The Mexicans want the United States better control the flow of weapons, flow of money, and that sort of thing. So I think there's certainly a desire that the U.S. do more. But, you know, the violence is not just a reaction to the army going in. We have to look a few years back and see that already these drug gangs were proliferating, fragmenting, and that also has caused a lot of the violence, in that it's become a much more competitive business. There used to be just a handful of cartels or organizations. Now there are many groups fighting for a piece of not just territory, not just the smuggling routes, but also for control of local markets. So there are many factors for why
right.
this is become so much more violent.
Well, let's pull one out. I mean, we could talk about this for an hour. It's just purely the threat to civilians alone in the border areas. But, Tracy, you referred to it a moment ago. The flow of arms from the U.S. into Mexico, the Mexican government has said that's got to stop. That would require a level of arms control or gun controls in certainly the border areas of the United States, some of those conservative parts of the country that we haven't really seen yet. Sam Quiñones, is this a demand by the Mexican government to actually crack down on arms shipments and sales near the border?
I mean, it's a demand. I'm not sure how many people are taking it seriously. I mean, the problem is, of course, that you have the state of Arizona, where you have very lax gun laws, gun shows, and so on. Plus, you have the great phenomenon of straw buyers, which is a lot how all this happens, where one person without a criminal record goes into a gun store, buys a lot of weapons, immediately turns it over to, sometimes is shopping with a cell phone, taking pictures of the guns to send it to someone who's actually paying for the whole thing. I mean, this happens fairly frequently, is my understanding, in places like Phoenix and elsewhere that I've been along the border. You know, and it's you're getting into kind of issues that have to do with our own culture. One is our
sure.
drug demand culture, and then another is our gun culture. Who knows? This may have to change. If I'm not sure if it will, because it is so ingrained.
It's certainly the clash. Tracy Wilkinson, I'll give you the last word in the last 40 seconds here.
Well, I think what's particularly alarming to the Mexicans is that these weapons are increasingly of military grade. You know, high caliber, 50 caliber guns, anti-tank weapons, grenades. The Mexicans could do a lot more, too, though, in setting up a better customs regime and controlling its border as well.
Well, a very volatile combination, guns and drugs, in the dramatic instability between drug lords and the Mexican authorities. Sam Quiñones, LA Times reporter, and Tracy Wilkinson, Mexico bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. Their series is Mexico Under Siege. Thanks for joining us. So stay tuned. You're going to be able to hear Education Secretary Arne Duncan on the program and have a chance to suggest something about your own school.
My name is Louise. I'm calling from Detroit, Michigan. And in Michigan, children are allowed to drop out at 16. And we are really at the bottom in terms of statistics for graduating and for dropouts. I'd like to know if there will be a national push again for attendance.
A national push for attendance, one idea from you. Listen to more on our website, and also stay tuned for Secretary of Education Arne Duncan on the program later on this hour.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
By August 31st, 2010, our combat mission in Iraq will end. I intend to remove all U.S. troops from Iraq by the end of 2011.
That's President Obama announcing on Friday he would soon begin to bring the troops home from Iraq. And under the plan, the 142,000 U.S. forces in Iraq currently would be drawn down to between 35,000 and about 50,000 troops, probably closer to the higher end, by August 31st, 2010. And all forces would then be withdrawn by the last day of 2011. Well, the question of speed here has been the focus of some Democrats who say maybe this is slower than Barack Obama campaigned on. And other sort of security experts have suggested that maybe it is too quick. But Peter Baker is a reporter for The New York Times who's been covering this. I have one question for you, and that is, insofar as you're able to tell me or tell, period, is General Petraeus, who was the architect of the famous surge last year, on board with this plan? And does this have the consensus of the generals?
Well, you know, the Secretary of Defense Bob Gates and Admiral Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said that both General Petraeus, who's now the head of the Middle East operations at CENTCOM, and General Odierno, who's the ground commander in Iraq, took over for General Petraeus, both are comfortable with the plan, is the way they put it. Very careful language. You know, in some ways, this plan reflects their input. General Odierno, with the support of General Petraeus, wanted a longer period of time to pull out. They felt like 16 months wouldn't work because they wanted to have enough forces staying in Iraq through the end of this year, when they're going to have parliamentary elections in December, and then to get through whatever transition of government that takes place after that. And then they could begin pulling one out, one brigade out a month. That would lead you to around August, which is the compromise date they came up with.
So 142,000 troops will basically be the level during the parliamentary elections later this year. But by late summer of next year, there'll only be 50,000 troops in there. I'm just wondering, that is such a low figure compared to what the generals were demanding of the Bush administration, and the tension between the generals wanting more, the Rumsfeld-Pentagon wanting less, really characterized that relationship during the Bush administration. How can it be any different this time around?
Well, it feels like that there, first of all, we don't know, of course, a lot of the internal deliberations, so everything we say, let's say, is caveated by what we think we know. But we have not heard, I think, of great tension in this discussion. What the White House people will tell you is there was a meeting of the minds between them and the military. And we haven't heard anything different, really, from the generals at this point. I mean, remember also that, as you said, the Pentagon looks at it differently than the ground commanders. They're looking at the overall health of the force and are looking at a new surge, if you will, of troops into Afghanistan that they need to find some bodies for. So, you know, they've just sent 17,000. They may go up to 30,000 more in Afghanistan. Those have to come from someplace, and essentially those are going to come from the drawdown in Iraq.
Well, Peter, here's Secretary of Gates on Meet the Press yesterday. I wonder what you make of this notion of a different mission now in Iraq.
They do have a very different mission, but that mission will be principally a training, assistance, advisory role. There will be a limited counterterrorism operations aspect to it, and we will still have some soldiers embedded with Iraqi units as part of the training effort.
Peter Baker, you know, now the Pentagon's back doing nation building again, something that they have claimed repeatedly that they're not really that comfortable with.
Well, you know, it's part of the transition at this point. And they're not going to be doing it for very long if we stick with the strategic agreement that President Bush had negotiated with the Iraqis before he left. That's the one that calls for all troops out by 2011. I mean, the plan that President Obama came up with on Friday, in effect, is sort of a logical way station between where we're at now and what the strategic agreement that President Bush negotiated calls for. I mean, remember, that agreement also calls for pulling out of all the cities by June of this year. In other words, a retrenchment from the very frontline role that the American military has been playing up till now and turning things over to the Iraqis. So you're going to see that transition this summer. You'll see the transition that President Obama has now put in place a summer from now, and then you'll see, in theory at least, the withdrawal of all troops by the end of 2011. That's right. The sort of glide path we're on.
Well, then perhaps the takeaway here, it would be that, for all the talk during the Bush administration of how we've invested so much, we can't leave without some sense of victory in Iraq. Maybe the notion that the Pentagon is pursuing here is a kind of a relief at leaving a conflict that is so unpopular in the United States and pursuing maybe those military gains in a place like Afghanistan. And meanwhile, the Pentagon has basically decided, we're done with Iraq. Do you think that's the consensus?
Well, I think they think that they're on the way to being done with Iraq, yeah. And I think that they think that they've been more successful there than they would have been or looked like it would have been just 2 years ago. It's not going to be, I think, what a lot of people would call victory. There's not going to be sort of a parade in the streets, and there's not going to be sort of this sense, perhaps, of triumph exactly. But there probably is at least more sense that they've accomplished something in these last 2 years. They have had some successes in the last 2 years than anybody would have imagined. I mean, violence has fallen by, I don't know what the number is, but probably around 80% or more, the lowest level, I think, since the summer of 2003.
No, the numbers are huge. I'm wondering if that's a justification for closing any bases.
Well, that's a good question. You know, we don't know exactly what will happen to the bases as they withdraw. Some of them, I imagine, will be turned over to the Iraqi security forces. And there's still a question of will we try to renegotiate this strategic agreement that calls for every soldier out by the end of 2011. You know, I mean, we often find American forces sticking around in smaller numbers for a long time in a place that there's been a war as sort of a stability kind of operation, a peacetime operation. Look at Germany, look at South Korea. The Obama administration says that's not the model we're going to follow. But, you know, a lot of people are suspicious that come a year from now, come 2 years from now, you might see them renegotiate with Iraq to have a small presence there that would remain beyond 2011.
Well, the infrastructure is in place. We've certainly paid for it. Peter Baker, reporter for the New York Times, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you. Appreciate it.
And now headlines from Femi Oke.
And the time is just coming up to 29 minutes past the hour. Senior military officers from North Korea and the U.S.-led United Nations Command in South Korea held their first talks in nearly 7 years today. The talks ended without gaining any ground. The international community is concerned that North Korea is about to test fire missiles. Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin's party racked up sizable leads in today's elections. Independent observers say the elections were awash in mass voting violations. The United Russia Party held large advantages in regional and local elections. The party dominates Russia's politics, and critics say that power is used to manipulate the ballot counts. And the Supreme Court will consider today whether an Alaskan man has the right to DNA testing. William Osborne was convicted of a 1993 rape, but says he has the right to have a DNA test performed on evidence found near the crime scene. Alaska is one of the states that doesn't allow this.
Fascinating. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. CNBC this morning is calling it a dip. The Dow dips below 7,000. Actually, it was a plunge this morning. Both the Dow and the S&P future, S&P are down about 2% this morning. As the markets open and react to the AIG news, largest corporate loss in U.S. history, and an additional $30 billion from the Treasury infused into AIG. AIG is the headline today, making market news. But last week, it was Citigroup that was unstable and dragging the markets down in financial sectors and everywhere else. CEO Vikram Pandit, the CEO of Citigroup, you may recall, raised his hand and testified last month, along with a bunch of other bank CEOs, before the House Financial Services Committee to explain all that has gone wrong in the year or more that he has been CEO.
I would also like to say something about the airplane that was in the news. We did not adjust quickly enough to this new world, and I take personal responsibility for that mistake. In the end, I canceled delivery. We need to do a better job of acknowledging and embracing the new realities. Let me be clear with the committee. I get the new reality, and I will make sure Citi gets it as well.
The question, of course, is can Vikram Pandit land Citigroup on the Hudson the way Sullenberger did, referring to the airplane there that was very much in the news when he testified on February 11th of 09. Joining me now is Joe Hagan. He's a contributing editor at New York Magazine who has a profile of the CEO of Citigroup, who, when he joined that company and was elevated to CEO, pocketed roughly $200 million from the sale of his hedge fund. Today he makes a dollar. As a result of a voluntary kind of giving up of his salary. Joe, what a year it has been for Vikram Pandit. Is this the right guy for the job?
Well, the consensus is that he's the only guy to do the job right now, because he might be smart enough to do it, but also because no one else wants it.
Right.
He himself admitted that his favorite blog headline is Vikram Pandit gets to keep his crappy job.
I saw that headline.
Yeah, so he, yes, and in fact, in the negotiations with the government that they've been having over these bailouts, the question of whether he will remain has come up, and the consensus out of the government, we're told, is that there's no one else, qualified and who will take it, who's going to work for a dollar a year.
Your story, your profile really tells a fascinating story. It's a Titanic kind of a Shakespearean tragedy of a man who comes into Citigroup and is the servant to masters like Robert Rubin
right.
and Sandy Weill, who have a vision of Citigroup
exactly.
that they want him to preserve. And now he's the servant of government masters who have God knows what vision for Citigroup. How does he respond to this?
Well, it was so fascinating trying to do this dance. They're trying to do this dance where they're trying to maintain dignity in the sense that they have control while also trying to run away from the image that they are under the boot heel of the government,
right.
which, frankly, they are. And they just can't help that. The fact that the government, now owning practically a third of the company, has the power to remove the board of directors completely tells you what you need to know. And this whole argument over nationalization, it's really, they've thread the needle such that they don't have to say it's nationalization. But the fact is they have immense power over a private company.
Which is a real step down. Listen to this. One of the things that Vikram Pandit has to do is to stop the sort of hatred of bankers that has grown up
right.
in this entire economic downturn. This comment is typical. It's from a frequent guest on our program and someone I'm sure you know, Maryland economist Peter Morici.
The whole balance sheet at Citigroup is corrupted. The business plans are flawed. This is what happens when a compensation package drives your business plan.
Is that fair, that their bank was basically just a compensation package and the depositors be damned?
Well, you could say that about, all of these Wall Street firms. And to varying degrees, some of them are driven even more by compensation than others. And in this case, many people saw Vikram Pandit's payment of the hedge fund that he owned, $165 million he personally made. It was an $800 million purchase as his compensation. And we're giving it to you up front.
In the beginning, yeah. Signing bonus.
That's right. And and now, because he made so much money, and it was such, in some people's minds, an egregious amount of money to have made for a hedge fund that didn't do that well and has since collapsed, that he owes them, he's basically indentured to continue riding Citigroup to wherever it goes, right?
Why did the math guy, and that's kind of what Vikram Pandit was,
right.
He was the guy who really understood the complex derivatives, and the
right.
the board decided we need to get out of the sort of traditional banker guy and
right.
get a math guy in here.
Right.
Why did he fail?
Why did Vikram Pandit fail?
Fail to restore the confidence.
Right.
It seems like this is not the moment for the math guy.
Well,
anymore.
that is the key thing that you hear from the people who are disgruntled at Citi is that they needed a leader who had the charisma, could corral the hearts and minds of the institution, because it's this crazy, unwieldy institution that's around the globe, and there's so many different divisions, and they're feudal and warring all the time. So you needed somebody who could really have the charisma. And he's a guy that won't even go in front of a camera. He's so, insular and not into being in the public eye. But now he's trying and flailing about trying to do what he doesn't really have the skill set to do.
And maybe it's better for Vikram Pandit to be this quiet, low-profile entity as the government takes over, rather than to have some big, brassy kind of Donald Trump character.
Well, that's true. But at the same time, he doesn't have a choice.
Right.
If he doesn't inspire any confidence, because the markets are so based on confidence right now, and he has to figure out how to give them that confidence, and that's a very tricky thing to do.
And tricky today, very little confidence on Wall Street. From pocketing $160 million to take this job and shove it, it's a story of Shakespearean proportions. I'd like to thank my guest, Joe Hagan. Joe's a contributing editor for New York Magazine. His profile of Vikram Pandit is in the magazine hitting the stands this week. Does that song run through Vikram Pandit's mind? I don't know, but Femi Okay might know. She's got the headlines.
Hello. Headlines coming to you at 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Just talking about the markets, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has plunged below 7,000 for the first time since 1997. The federal government announced today that it's providing an extra $30 billion to ensure the company AIG. The bailout is AIG's fourth since September, and it comes as the company announced its biggest quarterly loss in corporate U.S. history, and that loss was $61.7 billion. International donors are attending a conference in Egypt today to actually help for the reconstruction of the Gaza Strip. John Ging is head of the UN's Palestinian Relief Agency, UNRWA. Ging says that right now there's no access to Gaza, so getting aid in is just as important as the pledges.
Well, there's every point to have it pledged, and we're very grateful for the generosity that is already there in the indications that are coming through. But everybody needs to be clear, it won't translate into construction on the ground until this big access issue is solved.
And that's a political issue in Israel, right?
It absolutely is. He says, and Ging actually says, that there's not even a bag of cement getting into Gaza right now, so let alone all of the aid. A total of $3 billion is expected to be raised from this conference today. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says the U.S. will be given $900 million in aid.
So, that access point really puts it in context, though.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. If you're watching the market, both the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P 500 have bounced off their lows this morning as the futures contracts get unwound. But there still doesn't appear to be much confidence in either the broad market or the 30 industrials. Joining us now is Dan Gross, senior editor at Newsweek, to talk about what AIG announced this morning. In addition to getting $30 more billion from the federal government to continue its bailout, it also released the small detail that it had had the largest corporate loss in U.S. corporate history, $62 billion or thereabouts. Dan, how much more do we know about AIG, the insurance company, versus AIG, the questionable hedge fund at this point?
Well, look, with every passing quarter, we get a better sense of the absurdity of the situation there. AIG was basically a healthy life insurance company that did quite well insuring buildings and bridges and the sorts of things insurance companies do well, that they can calculate what happens when there's a storm, you suffer this much in damages. But they also became, that hedge fund aspect, a immense insurer of what they called financial products, which is to say mortgages and derivatives based on mortgages and interest rate swaps and corporate bond failures and things like that. They sold insurance policies on those types of products without setting aside proper reserves. And when that market melted down, all of a sudden it's like they're on the hook for tens of billions of dollars of claims that they have no ability to pay.
Now, you wrote the book Dumb Money, How Our Greatest Financial Minds Bankrupted the Nation. Let me just throw one at you here on the AIG question. So if the cash in AIG is in the insurance side, okay, mostly life insurance side, and the toxic assets are all over in the hedge fund side, is it the case that they're trying to guarantee these toxic assets with money that people gave that's going to have to be paid out when they die? So basically, they're being guaranteed by assets. Yeah, you see what I'm asking?
Insurance is a pretty heavily regulated industry, right? So like the regulated life insurance units that are kind of done on a state-by-state basis, they have to set aside a certain amount of cash to meet claims. So it's not so much the case that people might not get their claims paid if you have a life insurance policy, your family member dies, you will probably get paid. The larger issue is that insurance companies really need to have top-notch credit ratings, the best possible. Otherwise, who's willing to do business with them? Who's willing to entrust assets to them over a 30, 40-year period, right? Would you buy insurance from a company that you thought might be out of business or not be able to pay 10 years down the road? And the activities they did on the financial side have essentially destroyed that credit rating. So it makes it impossible, even if the life insurance business is functioning quite well, it makes it very difficult to raise capital or for other institutions to say, you know what, we'll do business with them. Why would they do business with AIG, which may not be around, when they could go to, Northwestern or MassMutual?
Well, Dan Gross, quickly, it raises the question, why don't we just spend the $30 billion on taking all the 70-year-olds and older who have AIG insurance policies and give them the best medical care possible to keep them from dying in the next 10 years? That'll save the economy.
That's one possibility. The other is,
quickly,
we need to liberate the good businesses from the bad businesses, and the only way we can liberate those, get someone else to buy them, is for the government to really formally assume all those losses.
Liberating the good businesses at AIG. Dan Gross, senior editor at Newsweek, thanks for joining us.
Anytime, John.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. In a moment, the U.S. Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, will join our provocative conversation on education in the 21st century. But Elise Barr, good morning.
Good morning.
You are principal at the Brooklyn School for Collaborative Studies. Is that right?
I am.
You called our program earlier and said that if you could take someone in educational policy or something in educational policy to the principal's office, it's an easy answer you would have to that question.
Yes, I suggested that I would take the entire United States Department of Education to the principal's office for relying too heavily on excessive use of high-stakes tests, which are tests of low-level thinking. And they're commercially made, they cost lots of money, and they are creating a system in which we are teaching children to learn for tests, and we are not teaching children to think. So we need to move to real-time assessment in classrooms with real teachers speaking to real children about real things, watching children learn, thinking, asking them how they think, studying their errors, and going deeply into the process of teaching and learning through actual educational research.
All right.
And,
That's fine. Stay with us, Elise Barr. That'll be the first question I put to the Secretary of Education, who joins us in just a second. Will you stay with us?
I will.
I noticed that you have a snow day today, correct?
Yes, and otherwise you would not be hearing from me.
Well, so the snow in New York is an advantage for us here in our conversation on education. Joining us now is Arne Duncan, U.S. Secretary of Education. He joins us from Washington, where there's some snow on the ground there in Washington. First of all, Secretary, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me, John.
And I'm familiar with your work in Chicago, where I went to a college, a challenging school system there, where you were the head. Let's start with the question that Elise Barr raised here at the beginning. Is it time to leave No Child Left Behind, or is it maybe a moment to rebrand No Child Left Behind, as you alleged, as you referred to on the Department of Education website a week and a half ago?
A couple thoughts. First of all, I agree with her that I think the bar is too low, that in too many states we've sort of dummied this thing down to the lowest common denominator, and in fact we need to raise the bar. I think our students today are competing for jobs, not down the block within the state, but they're competing for jobs with children in India and China. I think we need a higher bar. To her point, we need better assessments so that students have a chance to learn what their strengths and weaknesses are along the road. And when we talk about a higher bar, I mean internationally benchmarked, college-ready, career-ready standards. And we need to really tell the truth to our students and to parents about what students' strengths are, what their weaknesses are, and have great real-time assessments that she talked about to really give our students the ability to improve where they need to.
All right, Secretary, part of our excitement in having you on the program is that we get to put to you directly some provocative comments that were made on the program last week when we spoke about what education for the 21st century really means. And Bob Compton, an educational entrepreneur who was commenting on the stimulus package, says if we refund simply the status quo, we might not achieve the radical vision that he thinks we need. Listen to this, Secretary.
President Obama hired the right man, but now he's given him the wrong mission, and he's loaded him with $100 million to spend fast. This money is going to go into the states along traditional channels, and it's going to cement American education firmly in the 20th century.
Secretary Duncan, what do you think of that? Right man, wrong mission? Do you agree?
I don't, and this is obviously an extraordinary once-in-a-lifetime sort of historic opportunity to make things dramatically better. We have to push very, very hard for reform. I agree with the caller that the status quo simply isn't good enough, that we have to get dramatically better. What we can do with these new resources are a couple things. First of all, I talked about really raising the bar, raising standards, college-ready, career-ready, internationally benchmark standards. You need to develop great assessments behind that so you can tell a second grader or a third grader, are they on the way to college and being successful or are they not? You need great data systems. You need to be able to track student achievement year after year, track students against teachers, and track teachers back to their school of education to see which teachers are really making a difference in our students' lives. And then finally, we have to think very, very differently about how we reward teachers and principals. As you know, in education, talent matters tremendously. We have to get the best and brightest into education. We have to keep them there. And we have to reward them not just for success for students, but for taking on the toughest assignments, whether that's, you know, inner city, urban, or rural. And with the resources we have, we can dramatically challenge the status quo, not just invest in the status quo.
Well, you've already alluded to something that came up on the program last week, and that is monitoring students on a more or less continual basis using data systems that are being tried out here in New York and some other urban centers. But let's move on to the question of early childhood education. There was a question last week about where the money for early childhood education is really targeted.
In the recovery package, there's $5 billion investment in early childhood because he realizes this is important not just in the short term for the economy, but for the nation's long-term economic health, that you really need to invest in these years.
Now, Secretary Duncan, that's someone you know, Cornelia Grumman, who's talking about the first 5 years fund. She appeared on The Takeaway last week and talked about whether the money from the stimulus package is going to go to early childhood education in the 0 to 3 years, extending Head Start, or basically refunding the existing Head Start program. Which is it?
Yeah, it's actually going to go across the board. We need to do two things in early childhood. As you know, this is arguably the best investment we can make. There's nothing more important that our students that we can do than to get our students off to a great start. So in my mind, this money is going to accomplish two things. First is to increase access to early childhood seats. and there's a real shortage of seats available. But the second thing, equally as important, if not more important, we need to increase the quality of these seats. So if this is just glorified babysitting, we're really not changing our students' lives, and the students need the most help. But if our students have great teachers who have had great professional development, and they can enter kindergarten with their socialization skills intact, their literacy skills intact, then they have a chance to be very, very successful. So I think this is an extraordinarily important part of the recovery package.
Well, our listeners are definitely responding to your presence on the program. Here's a statement, a message that came in just this morning. Listen to this, Secretary Duncan.
Hi, this is a message for Arnie. I'm a teacher in New York, and what would really make a difference would be to make class sizes smaller. Anybody who thinks that class size doesn't matter is crazy and doesn't know anything about teaching.
Secretary Duncan, can the federal government do anything about that?
Well, I'll tell you what we've been able to do is we've been able to stave off a catastrophe. As you know, with the recovery package, we're going to save literally hundreds of thousands of teaching jobs. I think your call is from New York. I was with the mayor and the chancellor and Randy Weingarten, the president of the AFT in New York, 2 weeks ago, and they estimate that due to our state stabilization fund, we're going to save 14,000 teaching jobs in New York alone. And what I was really worried about was what I think would have been just an educational travesty, where we would have seen class size around the country go from, you know, 25 to 38 or 40. And with the funds in the recovery package, we're able to save many, many of those jobs. There's an estimate of as many as 580,000 teacher jobs being lost. So at this point, we're not able to reduce class size significantly, but we were able to ensure that things didn't get dramatically worse, which would have been just a terrible, terrible blow to children around the country.
Secretary Duncan, quickly before we go, a teacher emailed us and said, we need a new school equipped and designed for high school students that are pursuing professions in the arts. Tip of the hat to arts programs.
Very, very important. I think we have to really think about high schools around the country. We have to get dramatically better, and the more students have a chance to pursue their skills and their interests and dreams, whether it's the arts, you know, whether it's trades, whatever it might be, the more our students have a chance to really chase those things that they want to be successful in long term, and we provide many more concrete opportunities for students to pursue those dreams, but also to make real connections with adults. Our teenagers need adult mentors, role models more than ever before, and we have to make sure we're creating high schools where students have the opportunity to really connect in meaningful ways to adults and not get lost, not to be anonymous in big schools, which I think is a recipe for disaster.
All right, Secretary Duncan, on his way from one meeting to the next, U.S. Secretary of Education, thanks so much for joining us on The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me. Have a great day now.
Sure. More responses and more of the conversation will be on our website. Elise Barr, principal at the Brooklyn Collaborative Studies School, did the secretary have anything to say to you there?
I wish he would have addressed the resegregation of American schools, and I'd like to suggest to him also that we launch a national reading campaign inspired by the fact that we have a president now who is an intellect and a reader, and we can he actively shows us his reading life. So let's start a website where we can get volunteers like myself to respond to kids' posts about reading,
right,
and then let's have them be able to download certificates that celebrate them as readers. And let's not forget about Brown versus Board of Education. It was the best federal work that we did in education.
Ideas popping out of the woodwork. Elise Barr, principal of the Brooklyn School for Collaborative Studies, thanks for joining the conversation. And also joining our conversation is Farai Shadeya. She's the former host of News and Notes, multimedia journalist. That was your takeaway.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks so much, and we'll look forward to more on student loans as well,
something else
Duncan's working
on.
Right,
and you've done some work on that, actually.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so that is the takeaway for this morning. Thanks. The conversation continues online. Arnie Duncan will be taking your questions and everything about the conversation at thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.